Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling a really significant intellectual wave from the early 2000s, the New Atheism. You shared some incredibly insightful material with us, specifically Dr. Jim Spiegel's Philosophy of Religion lecture. And our goal, really, is to unpack what made this movement tick, how it differed from, you know, earlier atheism, and some of the compelling responses it generated.
Yeah, it was a period where these longstanding questions about belief and non-belief really just burst into the public consciousness with a whole new kind of energy. Spiegel's lecture does a great job mapping out the key figures and their, well, their central arguments.
Absolutely. This resurgence is often linked to Sam Harris's The End of Faith back in 2004.
Right.
And that was quickly followed by influential works from Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, and Daniel Dennett. These four, Dawkins, Harris, Hitchens, and Dennett. They even earned that rather memorable nickname, the Four Horsemen.
Yeah, dramatic label. But, you know, it does kind of capture the often forceful and unwavering nature of their challenge to religious belief.
It certainly does. And just to give everyone an immediate flavor of their approach, take Richard Dawkins's, shall we say, vibrant description of the Old Testament God. He called him arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction, and then just rattled off this list. Jealous, proud of it, petty, unjust, unforgiving, a control freak, vindictive, bloodthirsty, an ethnic cleanser, misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully. I mean, it's quite a statement.
Wow. Yeah, that quote really encapsulates the more aggressive and confrontational tone that was characteristic of a lot of the new atheist movement. It was a clear departure from, you know, more reserved forms of skepticism.
Exactly. And a core idea driving this movement, as Sam Harris put it, was a real emphasis on evidence and logic. He basically argued that when we're evaluating any claim, we should be using, you know, honest appraisal of evidence and logical arguments, full stop. He felt religion was getting a free pass, operating under a much lower standard of intellectual rigor. He really pressed this point in Letter to a Christian Nation, which is quite direct, written entirely in the second person.
Yeah, that direct address in Harris's book, it definitely creates a sense of immediate challenge. It puts the onus on the reader to, like, confront his arguments directly.
It does. And he made some pretty strong claims. For instance, regarding the 9/11 attackers, Harris asserted that they were men of faith, perfect faith. And then concluded that this is a terrible thing to be. That really ignited a lot of debate, didn't it, about the connection between religious belief and violence?
It certainly did. Harris's contention was that the attackers weren't acting out of some distorted version of their faith, but rather from the core tenets of their deeply held religious beliefs. A very provocative stance.
Yeah. Then you have Christopher Hitchens, who also had very firm views. He particularly disliked what he saw as religion's tendency to suggest a universe designed with you in mind.
Right, that idea of a grand plan.
Or this idea of a grand divine plan where everyone fits neatly, whether they realize it or not. He famously dismissed this as just too arrogant.
Yeah, Hitchens, with his trademark wit and intellectual sharpness, he often targeted what he perceived as a kind of unwarranted self-importance and maybe lack of humility inherent in many religious perspectives.
Right. Now, okay, atheism itself isn't new. People have questioned or rejected religious beliefs for ages. So what was genuinely new about this new atheism? What set it apart from, as Dr. Spiegel put it, your grandmother's atheists?
That's the key question, isn't it? While atheism has a long history, the new atheism brought a few distinct elements to the forefront. Firstly, as Spiegel highlights, there was a notable difference in attitude. This wasn't the often more cautious skepticism we see in figures like, say, David Hume or Bertrand Russell. The new atheists adopted a much more outspoken and aggressive posture in their critique. Spiegel even draws a comparison to the more confrontational style of someone like Friedrich Nietzsche and his challenge to traditional morality and theism.
Okay, so a more direct, less apologetic approach, less quiet questioning, more public challenge. Got it. What else distinguished them?
Secondly, there was a very strong, at least stated, emphasis on science. The new atheists consistently demanded scientific justification for religious belief.
Right.
Their basic argument was that if a belief couldn't be scientifically verified, then holding that belief was not only irrational, but for some, even irresponsible in our, you know, scientifically informed age.
So science became the ultimate yardstick for truth, at least when it came to claims about reality. Which leads us to their main objections, doesn't it? What were the key arguments they raised against theistic belief?
Precisely. Spiegel pinpoints two main objections that recur throughout their writings. The first is the age-old problem of evil.
Ah, yes.
The apparent conflict between the existence of an all-powerful, all-good God and the undeniable reality of suffering and evil in the world. Now, as Spiegel rightly points out, theologians and philosophers have grappled with this for centuries, acknowledging it as a serious challenge.
Sure.
However, the new atheists often seem to operate on the premise that this problem is inherently unsolvable and therefore a decisive reason to reject God's existence.
Right. They weren't just pointing out the difficulty, but presenting it as conclusive evidence against God.
Right. Okay.
And the second major objection was grounded in science, wasn't it?
Yes. Their second major objection stemmed from what they perceive as a fundamental conflict between religious doctrines and established scientific understanding. They specifically targeted core religious beliefs like the virgin's birth of Jesus, the resurrection, the divine inspiration of scripture, and various miracles.
Right.
Their argument was essentially that these claims lack scientific evidence or are contradicted by scientific knowledge, and therefore, for anyone claiming to be rational, these beliefs should be deemed unscientific and thus irrational.
Okay, so those are the core arguments of the new atheism. Now, Dr. Spiegel's lecture then moves into examining the responses to these arguments. One of the first areas he tackles is this intense focus on science, the idea that all beliefs must be scientifically justified.
Yes, and Spiegel highlights that this very demand is actually a philosophical position known as scientism, or sometimes positivism.
Okay.
And what's fascinating here is that this stance is, in a way, self-refuting. Mm. The assertion that all truth claims must be scientifically verifiable is itself not a scientifically verifiable claim.
Mm-hmm.
It's a philosophical statement about the nature of knowledge, not a finding you can get from a lab experiment. So, in essence, the new atheists are using a philosophical stance to critique philosophy, which creates a fascinating paradox.
Right. It's like that old saying about sawing off the branch you're sitting on. If you demand scientific proof for everything, where's the scientific proof for that demand itself?
Precisely. It undermines its own foundation. And beyond that, Spiegel points out that if we were to consistently apply this principle of scientism, it would lead to some rather, well, counterintuitive conclusions.
Yeah.
We'd have to dismiss as invalid our understanding of moral truths, our appreciation of beauty, and even our search for meaning in life. Science, you know, as a powerful tool for describing the natural world, operates in the realm of facts and empirical observation.
Yeah.
But it's fundamentally silent on questions of value, aesthetics, and ultimate purpose.
That's a really crucial point. If we strictly limit ourselves to only scientifically verifiable claims, we'd have to abandon so much of what makes life meaningful and what even the new atheists themselves often seem to advocate for.
Yeah.
Like justice and human rights.
Exactly. This raises an important question about consistency, doesn't it? How can one passionately argue for moral principles while simultaneously claiming that only scientific claims have validity? Where does that moral framework even come from within a purely scientific worldview?
Good question. And it gets even more interesting when Spiegel points out that science itself isn't built on purely scientific foundations.
That's right. Science relies on certain fundamental assumptions, what Spiegel refers to as unprovable articles of faith.
Like what?
Things like our basic trust in the reliability of our senses, the principle of cause and effect, the uniformity of nature, the idea that the laws of physics work the same everywhere, always, and even the basic notion that our thoughts can accurately reflect reality. None of these foundational principles can actually be scientifically proven. They are necessary presuppositions that underpin the entire scientific endeavor.
So the new atheists demand scientific proof for religious belief, but the very science they champion rests on assumptions that cannot themselves be scientifically proven. That seems like a pretty significant tension in their argument.
It certainly highlights a limitation in their critique. And moving on from the limitations of scientism, Spiegel then discusses the idea that there is, in fact, evidence that points towards the existence of God, even within a rational framework.
Right. He mentions some prominent figures who were once atheists and later converted to theism after considering this evidence, like C.S. Lewis and Lee Strobel.
Yes, these are well-known examples of individuals who, after rigorous intellectual inquiry, came to the conclusion that the evidence from various sources actually supported the existence of God. And Spiegel then shares a particularly compelling case study, that of Anthony Flew.
Ah, yes, Anthony Flew. He was a real heavyweight in the world of atheistic thought for decades, wasn't he?
Absolutely. For nearly 50 years, Flew was a leading atheist philosopher. His work significantly shaped the landscape of philosophy of religion. He was famous for advocating the presumption of atheism.
Right, the burden of proof idea.
Exactly, arguing that the burden of proof rested entirely on the theist to demonstrate God's existence.
He really set the terms of the debate for a long time. Yep. So what was it that led to his shift in perspective? It was quite a shock, I remember.
Yeah, it was huge. Around 2004, 2005, Flew made a rather surprising announcement. He had come to believe in some form of deity based on what he saw as compelling evidence for a supernatural intelligence behind the universe. This was a major international story, and he later detailed his reasons in his book, There Is a God.
Yeah.
Spiegel highlights a few key factors that influenced Flew's conversion: a deeper engagement with cosmology, and the apparent need for a first cause to explain the universe.
A cosmological argument, basically.
Mm-hmm. Also, the evidence for cosmic fine-tuning. You know, the seemingly improbable precision of physical constants that make life possible, and the persistent challenge of explaining the origin of life from non-living matter through purely naturalistic mechanisms, abiogenesis.
Wow. It's remarkable that these very scientific arguments, often used by new atheists to argue against God, were actually central to a lifelong atheist like Flew reconsidering his position.
It truly is, and it just underscores the complexity of these issues and how the same scientific findings can be interpreted through different philosophical lenses.
Absolutely.
Interestingly, Spiegel mentions that N.T. Wright, the renowned New Testament scholar, even asked Flew to consider writing an appendix to his book Addressing Christianity.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And while Flew didn't become an Orthodox Christian, he expressed a significant respect for Wright and acknowledged the possibility that if any religious tradition claiming divine revelation were true, Christianity seemed the most plausible. He cited the unique charisma of Jesus and the profound intellectual contributions of the Apostle Paul.
That's a fascinating turn of events. So, okay, if there is compelling evidence for God, as Spiegel and these examples suggest, then the question arises, why do some people become atheists or remain atheists? Spiegel then delves into a more biblical analysis of atheism, which I found particularly thought-provoking.
Yes, Spiegel notes that during the height of the new atheist movement's popularity, he was struck by the lack of attention given to what the Bible itself might say about the roots of unbelief. This led him to write The Making of an Atheist, where he explores this very question. He's particularly interested in understanding convinced, even, you know, dogmatic atheism, rather than just casual doubt or agnosticism.
And he draws on several key passages from the Bible to support his analysis, starting with Romans 1, I believe.
Exactly. In Romans 1, the Apostle Paul argues that God has made himself evident through creation, leaving people without excuse. Paul suggests that the primary reason some people don't acknowledge God isn't a lack of evidence, but rather a deliberate suppression of the truth, often driven by unrighteousness.
So from this biblical perspective, it's not primarily an intellectual issue, but a moral one at its root. He then moves to Ephesians 4, doesn't he?
Yes. In Ephesians 4, Paul speaks of a darkened understanding and alienation from God stemming from ignorance caused by the hardening of their hearts. Again, the emphasis is not on a lack of information, but on a volitional resistance to the truth, a choice.
And then Jesus' own words in John 3 seem to echo this theme as well.
Precisely. Jesus states that light has come into the world, but people loved darkness instead of light because their deeds were evil. This suggests a preference for remaining in darkness, motivated by a desire to keep their actions hidden, implying that unbelief can be a consequence of a person's moral orientation rather than a purely intellectual conclusion.
So the recurring idea in these biblical passages seems to be that rejecting belief in God isn't fundamentally about a lack of evidence, but more about a conscious or unconscious resistance to the truth, often linked to moral choices. Spiegel then introduces Alvin Plantinga's concept of the cognitive consequences of sin, which is a really interesting angle.
Yes, Plantinga, in his work Warranted Christian Belief, he posits that sin can negatively impact our cognitive faculties, damaging what John Calvin termed, and Plantinga also uses the sensus divinitatis, an innate human capacity for recognizing the divine.
The sense of the divine.
Right. It's important to clarify, Plantinga isn't suggesting everyone consciously perceives God all the time, but rather that humans have an innate cognitive faculty oriented towards recognizing the divine, a faculty that can be impaired or, well, ignored. Sin, in this view, can distort our ability to clearly perceive the evidence for God that Paul discusses in Romans. Spiegel specifically points to pride as a potential contributing factor for dogmatic atheists, suggesting it can create a kind of cognitive barrier to belief.
It's as if sin acts like a filter that distorts our perception of reality, making it harder to see the truth. But Spiegel also highlights a positive counterpart to this, right? That obedience can enhance cognition.
Absolutely. He notes that obedience and faithful living can actually sharpen our cognitive abilities and enhance our moral and spiritual discernment. He refers to passages in Proverbs and Jesus' teaching in John 7, where Jesus suggests that actively choosing to do God's will can lead to greater understanding and insight into divine truth. It's kind of a reversal of the common idea that we need intellectual certainty before committing. Jesus seems to suggest that commitment can lead to greater clarity.
That's a really intriguing dynamic. Okay. Spiegel then broadens the discussion further by exploring psychological explanations for atheism.
Yes, he examines Paul Witz's defective father's hypothesis from his book The Faith of the Fatherless. Witz, drawing on the work of figures like Feuerbach and Freud, who proposed psychological origins for religious belief, suggests that negative or absent relationships with one's father might be a contributing factor in the development of atheism for some. He bases this on his analysis of the lives of many prominent atheists throughout history.
It's interesting that he identified this recurring pattern of, you know, challenging or absent father figures in the backgrounds of so many influential atheists.
It is suggestive, although Witz himself is careful to emphasize that this is not presented as the sole cause of atheism or even a sufficient condition. Many religious individuals have also experienced difficult relationships with their fathers.
Of course.
However, it does raise the possibility that psychological dynamics can play a role in the formation of atheistic beliefs for some individuals.
Spiegel also touches on how intellectual theories can sometimes serve to rationalize pre-existing personal behavior, referencing the works of Paul Johnson and E. Michael Jones.
Yes, these authors explore how some intellectuals have developed elaborate theoretical frameworks that seem to, well, conveniently justify their own lifestyles and moral choices. Spiegel then connects this to William James's concept of the will to believe, and also psychological studies demonstrating how our beliefs can often shift to align with our actions, particularly in moral contexts. It can be psychologically easier sometimes to adjust our beliefs to fit our behavior than to confront and change deeply ingrained habits.
That makes a lot of intuitive sense. It's like our actions can exert a kind of gravitational pull on our beliefs. And then he introduces Thomas Kuhn's influential idea of the theory-ladenness of observation. How does that fit in?
Exactly. Kuhn argued that our pre-existing theoretical commitments fundamentally influence how we perceive and interpret data. Spiegel uses the classic example of the shift from a geocentric to a heliocentric understanding of the solar system to illustrate this.
Ah, right. The sun rising.
Yeah. Both geocentrists and heliocentrists observe the sun moving across the sky, but their underlying theoretical frameworks, Earth-centered versus sun-centered, led them to radically different interpretations of that same observation.
Okay.
Spiegel applies this to the question of atheism, suggesting that someone operating within a pre-existing atheistic worldview might interpret evidence in a way that reinforces their atheism, potentially leading to a kind of paradigm-induced blindness to evidence that a theist might find compelling. The geocentrism example really illustrates it. The same observed sunrise could be seen as the sun moving geocentric or the earth turning heliocentric, depending on the underlying belief system.
So someone deeply committed to atheism might encounter evidence that a theist would find persuasive, perhaps like the fine-tuning argument Flew found compelling, and simply interpret it through a naturalistic lens that aligns with their existing worldview, without even maybe realizing it fully. Spiegel also delves into the concepts of self-deception and motivated bias.
Yes, this refers to the tendency for individuals to cling to false beliefs despite contradictory evidence, often because they have a psychological or emotional investment in maintaining those beliefs or avoiding uncomfortable truths. The intriguing anecdote about the philosopher A.J. Ayer's near-death experience serves as a compelling example here.
Oh, tell me about that.
Well, Ayer, a famous logical positivist, had a near-death experience where he apparently saw things that seemed to point beyond the purely naturalistic. But even after this, he remained very reluctant to publicly renounce his long-held philosophical commitments. Spiegel suggests this might illustrate the powerful influence of maintaining one's scholarly reputation or deeply held intellectual identity, even in the face of potentially contradictory experiences.
Wow. It really highlights the complex interplay of intellectual reasoning and the personal psychological factors in shaping our beliefs, even for the most rigorously intellectual individuals. Finally, Spiegel concludes by discussing what he calls the blessings of theism. What does he mean by that?
Yes, he points out that theistic belief can provide a strong motivation for virtuous behavior, can foster improved cognitive well-being through that positive cycle of obedience and seeking connection with the divine we talked about,
right,
and offer psychological benefits through the capacity to express both lament the right to complain, as he puts it, and gratitude to God. He draws a contrast between the theistic perspective of gratitude for the wonders of nature and the human body and a purely naturalistic viewpoint that lacks a personal being to whom such thanks can be meaningfully directed.
So we've really journeyed through a lot in this deep dive, haven't we? We've examined the central arguments of the new atheism, explored a range of philosophical and theological responses, and even delved into some of the potential underlying factors contributing to atheistic belief from biblical and psychological perspectives.
We have indeed. Your initial goal was to gain a deeper understanding of this influential intellectual movement, and I think we've definitely developed a much more nuanced appreciation of its core ideas and the diverse and, frankly, thought-provoking responses it has generated.
Absolutely. And considering all the various angles we've explored today, maybe a final thought for our listeners. How might this idea of paradigm-induced blindness, this theory-ladenness of observation, influence our understanding of debates in other fields beyond just the question of God? Or maybe, if behavior can really influence belief, what implications does that have for how we approach big intellectual and spiritual questions? It certainly gives us a lot to consider. Thank you for sharing your insights and for joining me for this deep dive.